We are starting a new equipping class today for the next 6 weeks. I'm so glad we didn't cancel church today. We would miss out on all of this. So glad you're here. Thanks for coming out on a snowy Sunday. But what we want to do over the next 6 weeks is to just address the issue of marriage. And we want to do this, I guess, for a number of reasons. We've been here for 15 years. You've been married, and many of you, for many, many years. And I think most of you would probably admit that marriages are under attack in our country and just around the world. Marriage is always under attack. Satan always wants to destroy marriages. So what we want to do is just be very straight up and just say, let's address this. Let's talk about marriage. Let's do all we can to make sure that at Maranatha we're doing what we can do to encourage marriages to stay strong and stay resilient. So Satan's always attacking marriages. The curse is always operating in your marriage. You may not know this or recognize this or be aware of this, but underneath your marriage and all of our marriages, there's a curse operating. Genesis 3 tells us that. A curse on the woman, a curse on the man. And so it's always there. Even amongst believers, it's always there. It's always operating. And so I think we just have to be aware of that curse, and we need to constantly be, you know, pressing against that curse and keeping it from becoming a strong influence in our marriage. Added to that, here the last couple of years at Maranatha, we've had, I think, 6 or 7 marriages just blow up and disintegrate. And as elders, that just grieves our heart. It just grieves our heart when we see that happening. And oftentimes, by the time it gets to an elder or the elder level, it's almost too late. Not that it's never too late. Marriage can always be redeemed. But oftentimes, by the time it gets to us as shepherds, it's almost too far gone to deal with it. But we always want to deal with that. So we've seen that. So all of these reasons kind of just coming together, we thought it'd be appropriate to take one of our 6-week modules and address marriage. And we thought it'd be helpful to do it in teams. So we're going to kick things off today, Julie and I. This is not going to really be just a didactic. It's going to be more just talking, and once I introduce this to you, let me just kind of tell you how the rest of this is going to go. So today, Julie and I are going to talk about how marriage reflects the gospel, and just kind of be some, hopefully give you some practical things on that. Next Sunday, Dale and Kathy are going to talk about the value of communication. So you need to come back next week for Dale and Kathy. They're going to answer all your communication problems and solve all those things for you. No pressure, Dale, wherever you are. Then, what? There he is right there. Got that figured out for us?
No.
You're still communicating about that. That's good. All right. The week after that, Bob and Suzanne are going to talk about forgiving your spouse. So just how what role does forgiveness play in a marriage? The week after that, February 2, we're going to do something different. We're going to split up into men and women. And we don't normally do this, but on that Sunday, I'm going to come and talk to the men about leading your family with love. How do you set a tone of love in your family as a husband who shepherds your wife and kids? How do you do that lovingly? So I'm going to do that. And then Colleen Pope is going to teach the women about contentment in marriage. So we're going to have a split class that morning. Then on February 9, Michael and Jane Mosaicus are going to talk about parenting. And then Jim and Sharon on February 16 are going to talk about how to survive the long haul. And so how many years for you guys? 52. And so they're going to tell you how to make it to 52, at least. So that's kind of what we're going to do over the next 6 weeks. And that's just an introduction to our class. I think both Julie and I feel like we shouldn't be up here. Just to be honest with you, there's some of you that have been sitting there, out there, have been married 30, 40, 50 years. And honestly, I feel like you should be up here because we're no experts in this. But having said that, why don't we just tell you a little bit about us, our marriage. Julie's going to give you all the wonderful details.
Can you talk louder? Back here, they can't.
Yes, we can talk about it. We can try and do that. So she's going to just kind of tell you a little bit about our marriage, our relationship, and some of the things that we've navigated. And then we want to tell you specifically how we've tried to keep the gospel at the center of our marriage. And there's no great notes. We're not going to give you a handout. Just four words that we think kind of capture what we think, how we think that the gospel remains the focus of marriage. So, all right.
I guess most of you, or a lot of you, know our story. We've been married 26 and a half years. You had to write that down because I never remember. So it's 26 and a half years. It says right there.
What's our anniversary date?
June 19th. I don't do well in how long it's been, but we met in high school when we were juniors. We were 16 and dated our junior year for 9 months, and then it became evident Todd wasn't a believer, and so I broke up with him.
She dumped me.
I dumped him. It was a hard dump. Yeah, it wasn't easy. It was kind of sad, but I still liked him. I was really drawn to him, and I feel like from that point on, we kind of, our senior year of high school, didn't really talk, and then...
So we were on student council together, yeah. Senior year of high school. I was student body president. She was...
Executive board secretary.
And we're supposed to be in meetings together and like,
work,
talk
like,
to each other.
Together.
Stone cold silence.
It was really crazy. We talked through people, like, to get work done on the student council. But anyway, so freshman year of college, he went off to the Air Force Academy, and my mom talked to his mom and came home from the grocery store and said, oh, it's so hard, a basic training, Todd is just struggling, you should drop him a little note, let him know you're praying for him. You know? I was like, well, I'm not going to do that. And she's like, well, it'd be really encouraging. This is the day before email and whatever. So I wrote him a little letter, and he wrote back, and he's like, oh, thank you for praying for me. And they kind of started a dialogue of discussions on snail mail, because we didn't have internet or any cell phones even. And so through the process of writing letters for 2 years, he would come back and visit once in a while, and we'd go out, but I figured he was going out with everybody at home, because he was a nice guy, and so I didn't think a whole lot of it, and sophomore year, he sent flowers on Valentine's Day, and I thought, well, that's really nice, he does that for everybody, Christmas is rough.
The hordes of women, thousands of them, I'm buying flowers for him. I'm trying here, I'm trying.
I can say, though, on that Valentine's Day, I got flowers from two other guys. So there was. So, see,
I'm
I didn't think about it.
Concerned.
So, anyway, through then that spring of his junior or sophomore year of college, it's like God just kind of knit our hearts back together. Todd got saved, I should say that. That's sort of an important point. That through the process of this, I noticed he was changing spiritually, and there was a humility about him that was not there before. And so. It was very attractive to me, because I told you I liked the guy. I didn't really want to break up with him, but I knew I had to. And he was always my standard. It would just always come back to him. And so when he got saved, then it was just kind of, God just knit our hearts. We didn't really even talk about it. He just came home for summer vacation, and it was it. It was like, there it is. We're back together, and we talked one night, and he apologized for being a dummy in high school, and that was it. So then we started to date his junior year of college and got married after senior year of college. And then from there, we got moved to Spokane, Washington for his first assignment in the military. And I think that first year was probably our hardest year, one of the harder years, just balancing out like what roles look like. He grew up in a family that didn't have that, and I grew up in a family that did. So I went into marriage with the expectation of it would naturally happen. I would, you know, be the helper, he would be the leader, and he didn't kind of really have a clue what that meant, but at the same time, God brought a discipler to his life that started discipling him and asking the hard questions, keeping him accountable. His wife kept me accountable, and through that first year, things kind of started to smooth out. I mean, not that it's been easy since then, obviously, but every stage and transition of marriage and life, add kids, you know, add teenagers,
yeah, I think
it
the
all
hard
changes.
Part about that first year was she expected me to be the spiritual leader of our home. Grew up with an example of that. I didn't, and so I felt like she was asking me to be something that I couldn't be. I didn't know what it meant. I had no context for what does spiritual leadership look like in a marriage. And so she would get frustrated with me in a good way, in a sense, because I wasn't being what I should be. And I was frustrated back at her because she was expecting me to be something that I had no idea I was supposed to be. And so, I mean, this is very young, first 6 months of marriage. It's very immature in our understanding of the roles, and so it took a good year probably to figure those out and work through those things together. And so that first year of marriage was really hard.
It's very foundational.
You got to the point of thinking, what'd I do to this guy, with this guy? Right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was. I figured I just kind of have to get through nursing school and then just go live my life, and we'd be together but independent, because it was not happening. We were not connecting the way that we should. And I remember one fight in particular well, discussion maybe, I don't know if it was a fight, but all I know is he leaned up against the wall and slid down and said, I can't be your dad. And I had never brought my dad into this. It was just asking for spiritual leadership. And what he saw in my dad, he knew I was asking for at that point. I think that's sort of when the lights went on for both of us. Like, we need to get some accountability. We need some help and instruction on what that looks like, what my expectations should be with a new husband and him. You know, he was a newer Christian at that point, and just learning all of that and me being more understanding of even that process and understanding how he grew up so differently than I did, even though it looked Christian. It was so completely different. And so that was good. It was very foundational. I think that's why we're both really passionate when we do premarital counseling. We've done a lot because we want them. Our premarital counseling was 3 hours maybe total, and it just didn't cover enough. And, you know, you're going to love her, yep. You're going to lead her, yep. And you're going to submit and be a helper, yep. And that was it. And now we go 8 to 9 times with people over a course of like 6-8 months and really invest in them. Right. And yeah, I was going to say, you guys know Matt and Rosie too, right?
Matt and Rosie.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. But so we're really passionate about it because that first year is so foundational for kind of the trajectory of your marriage.
Yeah, so I guess we say some of those things to say, if you think because I'm a pastor and she's a pastor's wife, you got that's all figured out. We don't. We're still growing and maturing, and we've been through, you know, those first early years of marriage were very hard, especially the first year. God is very gracious, though, to grow us from that. But maybe I can just kind of dispel the notion that pastors have it all figured out. We have the same problems and struggles in marriage that you all do. And so this is just normal part of the sanctification process of marriage. So, and we're still working through this. So I think some of the things that have been challenges in our marriages, has been that first year, just figuring out roles. And then I think we've shared a little bit with you about just 9 years of having kids, 6 years, 7 years of trying to have kids and adoption and that whole process and just navigating the hardships of, you know, the adoption world. And those are some very challenging years to our marriage.
Going into ministry or not. He was wanting to go into ministry. I didn't want to. That was probably a 3-year process. Seems like, you know, God takes you in stages of marriage to, and we've been through quite a few of them. And now we're in teenagers and our kids are here, so we can't say anything about that. You didn't know that, did you? But raising teenagers is a whole new branch of parenting and that we're now working through. And it's, you know, at times it's not really easy. So it's stages, and I know people have told me retirement comes, and it's an adjustment in stages, and so I think all the seasons of marriage, we're at the point where we're raising teenagers now, so that's our stage.
So I think the thing that we've learned probably through all this is the gospel has to be the focus of our marriage. You all could share about struggles you're having or have had. You can talk about the difficulties in marriage. You can talk about some of the hardships you've been through, maybe are in right now. But the gospel has to be the focus of your marriage. And if it's not, I'll just be honest, there's not a lot of hope for you. You might be able to be nice and keep it together and cordial and that kind of thing, but you will never know the joy that God intended marriage to be if the gospel is not the focus. And that's what we want to talk about for just a few minutes that we have this morning. Turn in your Bibles to Ephesians chapter 5, because this is the text that links marriage to the gospel, and you probably know it well. Wives are given their role in Ephesians 5, 22 to 24. Husbands are given their role in Ephesians 5, 25 to 29, 30. And then look at verse 31 and 32. Paul says, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. Verse 32, marriage is a picture of Christ and the church. And so Paul is saying something profound here about marriage. He's not saying that God built the relationship between Christ and the church after the pattern of marriage. He said the exact opposite. He He says he built the pattern of marriage after the relationship of Christ and his church. So in other words, your marriage ought to be a living illustration of how Christ and the church relate together. So that's the key text that really connects the gospel to marriage. Your marriage, our marriage, ought to be a giant arrow that just shows people this is what Christ does in his relationship with his bride. And so the question we have to wrestle with is that the case? When God looks at our marriage, ours, when he looks at your marriage, when others look at our marriage, do they see a living picture of Christ and his relationship with his bride? In other words, I need to act in my marriage in the same way that Christ, similar way that Christ acts in his relationship with the church, and Julie as well. So that's the challenge, I think, is to keep the gospel central in your marriage. So, like I said, we have four words that we just wrote down. We don't have a handout, but you can just remember them or write them down. Just four words that we think illustrate how to keep the gospel central in your marriage. This is not rocket science. There's nothing profound here, but maybe we can just share those with you. And feel free to ask questions. We don't want to do all the talking, so you've already heard a sermon. So feel free to just throw your hand up or ask questions or give some comments. First one is love. This is obviously pretty basic, but the gospel is the greatest display of love the world has ever seen. And just think for a moment about the love that's displayed in the gospel. God did not choose to love us and set his affections on us because we were so lovable and so wonderful, and he just bled out this ooey gooey, rich and chewy feeling towards us because we were so incredible that he couldn't help but love us. That's not the gospel. You know the gospel. The gospel is we were destitute, depraved, wretched, wicked, rebellious sinners who God chose to love. And there's so many passages. Romans 5:8, God demonstrates his own love toward us, and while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. He didn't look upon us in such a way that his heart was just so turned towards affection with us. He actually looked at us and his stomach was turned by our wickedness and depravity, and yet he still chose to love us. That's the gospel. And so in marriage, that needs to be the same picture. And let's just state it clearly. You didn't marry a perfect person. You married a sinner. And sometimes that sinner is wicked and mean and sinful and unkind. And so how do you display the gospel in your marriage? It's got to be with a kind of love that mirrors the gospel. So I don't know if you want to add.
This week was, as I was reviewing it, it was Romans 5. Todd talked about it, 6, 8, and 10, just reminding me that I'm weak. I was ungodly. I was a sinner. I was an enemy. And we know that, you know, Christ is the husband and the church is his bride. Well, the church is filled with believers, which means all of us were weak and ungodly sinners and enemies. And he chose to love us when we were weak. It says in verse 6 and verse 8 says what Todd said, you know, we were still sinners. He died for us. And verse 10 is we were enemies, but we were reconciled to God by his death. And so for me, that just was a great reminder of, you know, when I'm not perfect or Todd isn't perfect, I've been forgiven much. I should be forgiven. I should forgive much. And just the reflection of Christ and what he did for me and his goodness and forgiving me and my badness and my yuckiness is what I need to do for him when he's not loving me the way that he should, and vice versa when I'm not loving him the way I should. So kind of perks my ears up when he comes to me and says, you know, something's going on. It's reminding myself to put myself into his shoes and kind of flip it around, like hearing what I'm saying to him, but hearing it how he's hearing it being said, so that I'm saying it with love and kindness and compassion for him, and hopefully in a way that he can understand and we can work through our differences that way.
So I think part of that is you hear people falling out of love. That's completely unbiblical. And if you sense your heart starting to move away from love and affection towards your spouse, that is completely unbiblical. That is anti-gospel. Because God's heart doesn't do that towards us. He could, because he would have every right to do that. But the gospel is the greatest display of love, and it continues to be the greatest display of love. So in order to model the gospel in your marriage, you and I, we all have a responsibility to keep our affections oriented toward our spouse. And so that means you never allow your heart to begin to fall out of love with your spouse. And so I think back on some of the marriages that we've seen disintegrate here, and those are some of the things we've heard. Well, I just don't love that person anymore. Then you don't understand the gospel. You don't understand the gospel then, because the gospel says you continue to love, and that's how we keep the gospel center. Now, just probably as a caveat, we're not talking about abusive marriages here. There's other marriages where there's some difficulties, and we have to maybe give a caveat that there's some issues that need to be worked there through. But in normal marriages, this is the issue. Your heart remains engaged in choosing to love, even if your heart is not wanting to. And if your heart's not wanting to, then you need to get some help to get your heart back to that point where you choose to love and you experience that love. So, I don't know. Any thoughts on this? It's the first word, love. I told you this is not going to be any rocket science, but yeah, Dale.
Yeah, love is a choice. It's not an emotion, not necessarily an emotional feeling. So there are many times in marriage you have to make a choice to love, even when things aren't necessarily good.
Exactly. Exactly. Word number two is sacrifice. So the gospel is, again, the greatest display of sacrifice the world has ever seen. Just think about what the gospel is. The gospel is the perfect Son of God, sinless in his perfections, completely holy and pure, and not worthy of any type of punishment or wrath. And yet, John 15 says he sacrificed himself for us. No greater love does man have than he lays his life down for another. And so the greatest display of sacrifice is at the cross. If you want to see sacrifice, you just need to look at the cross. And so that nowhere else are you going to see a higher display of sacrifice. And so when we say the gospel has to reflect marriage, you have to think about the level of sacrifice that you're willing to put in. And I guarantee none of us have put in that level of sacrifice in our marriage. None of us have, because you're still here, and I'm still here, and no one has sacrificed themselves to the point of death. I think many of us guys think we want to go out in a blaze of glory and sacrifice ourselves, and, you know, a gunman walks in the door and starts ripping off bullets, and we, you know, stand in the middle and take one for our wife and go down as a hero, and I sacrificed my life for my spouse. Well, that's cool, but are you willing to crucify yourself? Are you willing to die to yourself? Because let's face it, the greatest threat to your marriage is you. Now, that'll minister to you, encourage you, right? The greatest threat to your marriage is you. The greatest threat to our marriage is her. No, I mean me. The greatest threat to your marriage is yourself. It's the damage that we each can do in our marriage because of our sinfulness and because of our unwillingness to turn and serve the other person. And so the way you display the gospel is by dying to yourself. And let's face it, that's a challenge. That is not easy. Every morning you and I wake up, we have a choice of whether I'm going to serve myself and my needs and my wants and my desires, or whether I'm going to be willing to sacrifice those and put the needs of my spouse before myself. So it's just Philippians 2. That's all it is. It's just Philippians 2. In humility, consider others better than yourself. And where does Paul go for the illustration of that in Philippians 2? What's the example?
Christ.
It's Christ. He says, in humility, consider others better than yourself. Have yourself in yourself the same attitude that Christ has. And then he goes into that incredible illustration of Christ sacrificing himself to the point of death, even death on a cross. So if you want your marriage to exemplify the gospel, and you're not sacrificing anything for your spouse, I can just tell you, quite honestly, your marriage will never represent the gospel. And so we've, I think, had to come face to face with this reality that my sin is her greatest threat. My sin and my wickedness and my desire to pridefully defend myself is the greatest threat to the unity in our marriage. So I don't know what else.
I just always go back to I'm motivated by grace to love and stay committed, because I think of Ephesians 1 when it says, "But God being rich in mercy," when we were dead in our trespasses and sins, made us alive together with Christ, by grace you have been saved. So I don't deserve it. It's when I was dead in my trespasses and sins, but God reached in and saved me. And so my motivation is grace. If my motivation is grace to love when I don't want to love, to sacrifice when I don't want to sacrifice, to stay committed when I don't want to stay committed. Because, I mean, we all are married, those that are married here, and know it can get ugly, it can get hard, it can get yucky, and it'd be easier to step away and just say, forget it, it's not worth it. But then we remember that I'm motivated by the grace that God has given me when I was weak and a sinner and helpless and very foolish, and so that's my motivation to stay, to sacrifice. I was jumping ahead, but... Yeah. To sacrifice and stay committed.
One of the things we say in premarital counseling is marriage is not about you. And I think this is, sometimes you see the couple just reel back a little bit. Wait a minute, it is about me. Like, it's our day, you know, it's our wedding. No, it's not about you. And you get into marriage a little while and you realize quite soon that marriage is not about you. Marriage is about Christ. And so... you have to wrestle with why God has you married. There's some wonderful reasons He has you married to be, you know, have a companion, to start a family, to enjoy the physical part of marriage. There's some wonderful things that come from the marriage that we get to benefit from. But frankly, marriage is not primarily about us. Because what is He wanting to do? What is God wanting to do? To glorify Himself in our personal holiness and sanctification. So... one of the things we tell our premarital couples is you have to realize that the reason God is putting you together is not just to have sex. The reason God is putting you together is so that that person can be an agent of God's sanctification in your life and to teach you to die to yourself. That puts marriage in a whole different category, in a way that we normally don't think about it. We think about what benefit's going to get to me, or the joy that's going to come to me from marriage. And there's those things. We're not saying that there's not there. But we have to kind of see the overall picture of marriage and see it from God's perspective. Why is God sovereignly ordaining two people to come together? Ultimately, it's to make them more like Christ. And so you need to see your spouse as the Holy Spirit incensed in your marriage. Right? I mean, my wife is one of the primary means that God is sanctifying me. And same thing in your marriage. And so what He's going to do through the process of that is peel those fingers back, those fingers of selfishness and pride and selfish ambition that destroy and are the cancer to your marriage. So that's where sacrifice has to be a huge part of that. So... any other thoughts? We're not doing this perfectly, folks. We're not doing this perfectly. There's conflict still. And these are some of the things that we're working on. Third word? Questions? Comments? Third word, commitment? Someone?
I was thinking like the first two words are really back. Little I know about the Greek, kind of one and the same. We think about love mostly as Americans and as English speakers in an emotive, feeling, sensual sense, but the biblical love, that sacrificial love, selfless love, agape, I get helpful going back to like having distinctions of types of love.
Yeah.
When we're talking about it, so like defining terms, what do we mean by love, rather than just kind of assuming the cultural.
Very good. Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. So, phileo love is your friendship, relational love. Eros is your erotic, sexual love. But agape is your love of sacrifice, your love of willingness to die to self and serve other people. And so you're exactly right, Nate. Love is the affection or the emotion that drives the spirit of sacrifice. They're tied together. You can't separate them. Which then you come to the third one is commitment. Want to talk about commitment?
As I was thinking about commitment this week, Jesus gave everything up for His bride, the church. And I was thinking, we were talking about it, does He commit Himself to do what He has promised? and he doesn't break his promises. And I looked in John 14, and it says he's going to come back for the church. He's going to come back for his bride. John 10 says nobody can snatch me from his hand. He's with her till the end of the age, Matthew 28 says. And then he promises to make the church spiritually pure in Ephesians 5, and that's the same with a husband and a wife and a marriage. And I thought, you know, those four things, that's like some serious commitment. He's with me to the end of the age. He's going to come back for us. Nobody can snatch me from my Father's hand. I mean, there's been many times I go to John 10 with that, when you're struggling and trials and tribulations come and difficulties, and it's like, I can't get snatched out of my Father's hand. Nobody can come and get me from there. And so that's the kind of commitment to have in marriage, is nothing can get between us, because we're committed to each other, mimicking Christ's love for us and the church. And that's a pretty solid commitment at that point, that whatever comes, teenagers, the whole thing. I see him back there, I'm like, teenagers too. And things just changes in marriage, and you know, people have illnesses come through, and there's just always hardships and things that happen, and yet that commitment is to be like Christ. And that's a pretty heavy commitment. Christ gave us a big commitment when he said he loved us and saved us.
Yeah, so there's the practical implications of that. One of the things we say in premarital counseling is, if you ever float divorce as an option in your marriage, you've crossed the line far, far, far across the line. Because that doesn't mirror the gospel. The gospel is God has committed himself to us in Christ to save us, redeem us, sanctify us, glorify us, take us to himself. He's not going to break his promises, as Julie just said. And so how do you model that in your marriage? You model that in your marriage by never floating something that would destroy that commitment. If you get to a point and you're frustrated and you're angry and you just throw out casually or cavalierly, let's just get divorced, you cross the line. I would challenge you never, ever, ever, ever to make that an option. It never comes on the table. And we've done, I can't remember, 55 or 60 premarital counselings. And we talk about this, and we make sure that this is never going to be an option. And invariably they say, oh, of course not, never, never going to be an option. And we look back on those 60 marriages, and I think three or four of them are already divorced. What happened? You forgot the gospel. You forgot commitment. You forgot what God has committed to us, himself to us, in the gospel, and you failed to keep the gospel central in your marriage. And so, I mean, let's just be honest. There's times when you want to throw in the towel. Julie admitted early in our marriage there were times when she thought, I'm not sure what I've done in marrying this yahoo. And, the thought comes up, man, I could escape. I could go and just have a life by myself and not have to worry about this. If you get to that point, you've gone too far. That is not a gospel-centered marriage. And I think on a real practical basis, just how do you look at other people? Do you let your heart affections start to go to someone else in your mind, in your heart? Have you looked at a woman or a man and thought, man, what would it be like to be married to that person? If you start to venture down that road, the gospel is no longer the focus of your marriage. You're breaking in your heart a commitment that you made, and the gospel is no longer informing that marriage. So, thoughts on that? Questions? Just trying to give you some real frank ways that we've tried to put this into practice. The last one is forgiveness. And we don't want to take a lot of time here, because Bob and Suzanne are going to take a whole time on this. But think about the gospel. The gospel is about forgiveness. God, in his grace, extended to us Christ, gave us Christ. He died, he sacrificed himself, he rose again from the dead. Now he draws to himself those who are his, and he forgives us. And that is absolutely remarkable, that we who are the least forgivable people have actually been forgiven by God in Christ. So when you think about a gospel-centered marriage and you think about keeping it central in your marriage, there has to be frequent, daily perhaps, forgiveness between a husband and a wife. And if you're harboring bitterness, if you're harboring a record of wrongs, what does 1 Corinthians 13 say? There's no record of wrong, right, in love. So if you're keeping track of things in your mind, we've been reading this book by Alexander, is it Strzok? I'm Leading with Love, I think it is. And he told a story about a woman who comes into a counseling session with about an inch and a half thick paper trail of all of the offenses that her husband committed against her in 10 or 15 years of marriage. And she slammed it down on the desk. This is what's wrong with our marriage. And the guy said, well, clearly the problem is that you're partially harboring this bitterness. You haven't forgiven. And so if you want the gospel to be the focus of your marriage, you have to extend forgiveness. Now, we can get into the discussion of what if I don't repent, and we can, all that, there's a whole separate tangent and sidelines that we could go down, but there has to be a willingness to forgive and move on and not harbor those things against each other.
This just goes back to what I said before, just motivated by grace to love, motivated by grace to sacrifice, motivated by grace to keep the commitment, and motivated by grace to keep forgiving, because marriage, you hurt each other. They're the closest sinners that you're living with. You're going to hurt each other a lot and rub up against each other and cause irritation all the way to just anger and frustration. And seasons are harder than others, and there's times when you have a lot of time together and times that you don't. There's times you're in the Word and you're not in the Word, and it all is reflected in marriage because it's the closest relationship you have on earth. And so without forgiveness, it's doomed, because bitterness will creep in on both sides, and then we have irreconcilable differences and it's over and whatever. And so, and that one I'd encourage too is accountability partners are really important for both husband and the wife. Because if Todd would say to me, you know, are you harboring bitterness against me? It's like, you know, no. And yet, you know, it's because I'm mad, you know, or I'm upset. And yet I had somebody ask me this week if I am, and just to keep me on track. And I appreciate that, because it gives you pause and it's like, okay, let me think. I'm going to think this through and do a heart check. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's something that we have to have in our lives as accountability partners. And for, you know, older women, we talk about discipleship a lot, how valuable that is to have people asking, how are you doing your marriage? It's what laid the foundation for ours was Todd meeting with John Smith for 5 years, every Thursday or Tuesday at 5 a.m. Then they just faithfully, John just constantly asked him, are you loving your wife? Are you sacrificing for her? You know, what's going on? Are you bitter against her? And that, and his wife was doing the same with me, and that changed everything in those 5 years. And we went to seminary, and you know, here we are. But it's that is just so important, and I know our church really loves discipleship, and that's a big, big reason why, is someone who's willing to ask the hard questions and be, what is that, a no man or a yes man? Remember we talked about that, like the young people, so you can surround yourself with people that just say, oh, no, you're great, or you can have people that surround you with, yes, there's something you have to work on in your life, and we want to have those yes people, I think is what it's, wasn't that the expression?
The other way around,
I don't remember, but you want the person in your life who's going to be willing to ask the hard questions and not just smooth it over with, you know, oh, it's fine, you'll be fine, or oh, it's on him for sure. You want somebody who instead is going to get in your own kitchen and, or your grill and, you know, ask the hard stuff.
So, those are four words: love, sacrifice, commitment, forgiveness. It's how to keep the gospel the focus of your marriage. Nothing hard. I mean, it's hard. It's not complicated. It's hard at times, but it's not that complicated. So, questions? Yeah.
Going back to the story when you said the first year of marriage was really hard, and then you said, by God's grace or something, someone came into Todd's life to discipleship him. Were you guys seeking at that moment, or did it just happen? Like, they came and said, look, I need a...
I was not seeking it.
You were.
So Yerim's asking, were we seeking discipleship at that time, in that first year of marriage? I didn't even know what discipleship was. I had no concept.
How did they respond to it? When they, like, did they initiate it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he initiated with me. Todd, you want to get together, have some breakfast every once in a while, talk through things, and I just thought it was a free meal. I mean, how could you say no to that?
At 5 in the morning?
Well, yeah. 5 in the morning, that part hurt a little bit. Yeah. But, you know, it was God's grace again. I think I knew enough. I mean, I was kidding about the meal a little bit, but I think I knew enough that I needed some mentoring in the marriage. I think I knew I needed some discipleship in terms of being a spiritual leader. And so I recognized that perhaps something could come of it through that relationship. So, no, we weren't seeking it, but God was faithful to put those people in our life. And I think it goes back to just the importance of being a church that's committed to that. So it's one of the reasons we've tried to just constantly say, this is so important. You need to be involved in people's lives and et cetera. So.
Follow-up question.
Yep.
So if that person didn't initiate, let's say, and then you guys were kind of still on that phase, mm-hmm. would you guys have pursued something? Or, and this question is more for Julie, as a wife, would you have suggested something? Like, how do you balance between being too forward
mm-hmm.
and dominant
yeah.
versus really wishing the best
mm-hmm.
for your husband?
I think eventually probably I would have. We had, when Todd and I got married, he was an evolutionist. And so I did my best not to harp on that, and but yet I'd leave little Answers in Genesis things all over our apartment. Like, yay, period. And,
real subtle.
You know, trying to do it subtly. But I think that eventually I would have found help just because of the culture that I was raised in versus being raised in a different environment. But I think eventually I would have gone crazy enough that I would have been like, we seriously need help. I need to see somebody. And then pray. I prayed a lot. My mom told me that. Like, you just keep praying for him. And my dad would say that too, just keep praying for him. He's a smart guy. He'll, you know, it's going to take somebody other than you to tell him truth. And John Smith, by December of like 2 months after moving there, he comes home and I was sick from, so I couldn't go to small group. And he comes home, he's like, hey, guess what? And I'm like, what? He goes, John Smith told me tonight that Genesis 1 day is a 24 hour period. It's the word yom. And I'm laying on the couch sick and looking at him like, really, seriously? Because I've been saying that for 3 years. He's like, whoa. So it takes other people to come alongside. And my parents had encouraged me with that, to, you know, it will be somebody else, not me probably. You need to pray. And so I was like, okay. And then God brought John Smith and Martha.
Are you going to tell him something, you know? That
I know, right?
I'm a little reluctant here to call on you.
You know the rest of the story? We met John and Martha Smith sometime later after Todd was mentoring with him. And Sharon asked John, how did you know that you wanted to meet with Todd one-on-one to mentor him? He said, I have been praying for a young man for 2 years. And when Todd walked in, I knew that he was the man. So that's outside of, you know, you were seeking or he was seeking you, but God sovereignly worked out those details. And it was an answer to our prayer also, that he would not be an evolutionist anymore.
Lauren.
How have y'all's arguments changed from, like, how do you argue well? when you think of, like, when you were first married or thing, are there certain things that you put in place to have more constructive disagreements? How would you recommend when we disagree and you're both, you know, like...
I always say, ask Dale next week. Oh, we haven't argued well.
It's probably our weakest spot in marriage, if we really are honest, it's that. When difficulty comes up, it's hard to communicate well and stay focused. And we even just recently have had some issues with some things and talking it through and wrestling through it, and we just were at a stalemate, and he just started to pray. And it was like, that's exactly all we can do at this point. And I think it was 2 or 3 nights in a row, we're in the middle of the discussion, it's not making headway, and we're both exhausted with it, and he just started to pray, and the next night he prayed, and the next night he prayed, and now we've been faithfully praying, and it's, you know, keeps that issue at the forefront so that we actually talk about it with the Lord and each other instead of getting frustrated with each other and not talking it through, because we're on the same team, and he'll forever be my best friend, and so it's not like I'm just like, I want to have a big communication problem here, but we talk about that in premarital too, it's our weakest link. It's definitely communication and a disagreement is not easy.
I think in the early years it was a lot of anger and raising a voice and
you get quiet and I get frustrated and I raise my voice. Pretty much.
But there were times it was flip-flopped. I'd be more frustrated, she'd be more quiet. I mean, so we've not handled that well. But I think, you know, as God sanctifies us, we realize that this has to be talked through in a God-honoring way. Right? The anger of man does not accomplish the righteousness of God. So this has to be a humble approach to that conversation. There has to be a willingness to die to self and just be willing to have the hard conversations.
Because they don't go away. You wake up in the morning and they're still there.
Yeah, you can go to bed silent and...
wake up and there he is.
They're still there.
Yeah.
Mr. Towers. How long have you been married?
57 years.
57. Why aren't you up here?
We've only had 25 years of marital bliss. And for those of you who haven't been married that long, you know, and I consider short term as 12, 15 years. If you think for a minute the problems are going to go away, you got to stop and start praying, because they don't go away. As a matter of fact, as you get into those twilight years, which I'm getting close to, when you get into those twilight years, you'll find that people have become more set in their ways. And when you start worrying about that other person being set in their ways, you need to stand some time in front of a mirror. Because it gets tougher, not easier.
Yeah.
Yep. The problems, I think, are more picky than critical. You know, you're gonna get to a point, if you stay married long enough, you're gonna get to a point to where stuff is paid off. So you can't argue about that. That can't come from you. The kids are gonna be growing, God, yes. And you will live through teenagers.
Really?
It's not an easy 30 years, but you'll
live. We have four of them, Mr. Todd.
But if you think this gets easier, it really doesn't. It's a full-time job from the day you're married until you die. Just like Jesus loving us is a full-time job for him. So we gotta do whatever we can to make it more bearable for Jesus, and that's to reach out to it.
Yeah.
We have to do the same thing in our marriages.
That's good. In other words, marriage always takes work. It takes work till the day you die. So, absolutely.
Yeah.
We got to wrap it up here.
Three words.
Yes.
Patience. Because God is so patient.
Absolutely. All right, next week is Dale and Kathy, so come with your questions for them on communication. And thank you. Good discussion.
You've been listening to Maranatha Bible Church in Comstock Park, Michigan, where we exist to display God's glory, declare God's truth, delight in God's Son, and disciple God's people. No part of this digital file may be reproduced or distributed without prior written consent. For permission, go to mbcmi.org.